I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder. You know, folks, we're on a mission to rebrand aging because we've all been brainwashed about what's possible as we age. Age is not a disease. It's an opportunity.
And we're going to tell you how to seize that opportunity by growing bolder. And we've got some great examples for you today, including a multiple New York Times best-selling author and a wellness expert who says it might be time to change your diet.
We're going to visit with one of the most unusual clubs anywhere, the renowned Brain Fitness Club, and we'll chat with America's oldest teacher. And
speaking of oldest, Mark, how about the 93-year-old guy who ran coast-to-coast and the rapidly growing importance of genetic testing in the creation and delivery of life-saving personalized medicine? Well, it's all coming your way on Growing Bold. You know, we're barely getting started, and I'm hungry already. I just wish, Mark, that there would be something you could eat that you didn't have to worry about that was healthy and delicious at the same time. Maybe we can find out how to do that with our next guest. She is a New York Times best-selling author. She's written The Lean, Veganist, and Quantum Wellness. And her latest effort is The Book of Veganish, The Ultimate Guide to Eating into a Plant-Based, Cruelty-Free, Awesomely Delicious Way to Eat, with 70 easy recipes that anyone can make.
That is a mouthful, and a healthy one at that. The book was written for what she calls the vegan curious, which is a very large and growing group for several reasons. Let's find out more as we welcome Kathy Freston. Hey, Kathy, how are you?
Hi, guys. I'm well. Thanks for having me on.
You know, we hear about veganism almost daily. Doctors, longevity experts all extol the many benefits of a plant-based diet. From your perspective, what is the primary motivation these days that's driving people to veganism? Is it overall health? Is it a fear of cancer? Is it concern for the animals? What is it?
Well, you hit on two really important things, and the research shows that they are equally important. Probably half of the people interested are there because of health. They've been told by their doctors they need to reduce their cholesterol, they need to lose weight, they have issues with type 2 diabetes, they want to prevent cancer. The other half is aware that animal cruelty, it exists in such a big way in slaughterhouses and factory farms, so they want to avoid eating too much meat because of that reason. So, and then there are some people like me who are interested in both.
And then finally, I think there's also got to be a third component to the people that are just concerned about the environment and sustainability, huh?
Yeah, and what's interesting is that was kind of a quiet issue that no one was really aware of for a long time. Even the environmental organizations weren't speaking about it. But the truth is, you know, the United Nations did a study called The Livestock's Long Shadow, meaning it livestock industry casts a very long shadow on the environment, and in a lot of ways. So one thing, it pollutes the water table because the runoff from factory farms inevitably gets into the water table. And animals suck up so much water. They drink so much water as they become fatter and getting ready for slaughter. So a lot of the water, you know, I live in California where we have a drought here, and it's a big agricultural state. So that's a real concern for people like us. Monoculture, the loss of biodiversity because of all the corn and soy that is grown for animals. So we've turned into sort of a monoculture. And most importantly, anywhere, some scientists would say 18%, some would say 51% of greenhouse gases are caused by animal agriculture. So that's a really big concern with climate change. So for all of those reasons, environmental organizations are really taking notice of animal agriculture now. And I think the younger generation in particular is saying, you know what, we need to cut back on meat for the environment, for the animals, and for our own human health.
Wow. You know, I feel like I'm so far behind you and Mark as far as understanding all this. I get the animal versus the plant thing, but I get all hung up once we get into like vegetarian and vegan. How is veganism? What exactly is veganism?
Well, to be vegan means that you just avoid all animal products so that you're, so not only meat and chicken and fish, but also milk and butter and eggs and stuff like that. But I just want to say right here that when I first heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, there's no way I could do that. And that's why I really like the term vegan-ish, because you don't have to be 100%. You can be someone who's interested in moving away from eating animals, but you're not committed to giving up your favorite cheese fries or the occasional burger or whatever it is, but you can lean toward a primarily plant-based diet.
We're speaking with New York Times bestselling author Kathy Freston, who has a new book out called The Book of Vegan-ish. And maybe you just hit it, Kathy. What do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about adopting a vegan diet? What keeps us from taking that step?
I can tell you, it sounds so hard and restrictive. And the truth is, it's not. But because we grow up, if you're anything like me, and you grew up eating chicken and, you know, barbecued ribs and burgers and steaks and all that stuff, that's what you know. And so I think the idea of, oh my gosh, I have to give up all my favorite foods, that's really restrictive. And that's why I was like, there's no way I'm going to do that. But I am going to investigate. I'm just going to look into it. I'm going to try some new recipes. I'm going to order a little differently at restaurants. I'm going to try more ethnic restaurants like, you know, Thai and Mexican, which has lots of plant-based foods like beans and tofu and rice and vegetables. And then you realize, oh my gosh, it's not that hard. So if you start crowding out animal foods rather than cutting out, I think you have a better experience, because then it's more of an adventure. It's more fun rather than restrictive and like, oh, I can't have anything that I grew up with, anything that I love. You realize you actually can. It's just better versions, sort of tweaked traditions, and you really don't miss out on anything. But I'm a big believer in doing it gradually, easily, finding your way, hence the ish on the Book of Vegan-ish. I'm all about the ish.
You know, Kathy, it's really interesting because to me it's a lot like exercise. Nobody's listening to us saying, oh, no, she's wrong, who you don't do that. We all know we should do it. It's just tough. You know, what happened in your life that made you do it, and how tough was the transition?
Well, I was writing books on how to sort of be more aware in relationships and, you know, meditation and all of this stuff. And I thought, you know what, Kathy, you don't pay any attention to your food. And so you're kind of a hypocrite if you're talking and writing about being more awake and aware in your world and more conscious, and you're not even looking at where your food comes from. And the reason I didn't look at it is because it's hard to look at. You know, you really don't want to know where that hot dog came from. You really don't want to know how the bacon got to your plate. And you don't really want to know what it does to your body because it's so damn enjoyable. So I just thought, I don't want to be a hypocrite in my writing. I'm going to start reading about it, looking at the videos online, and I became really uncomfortable with what I was seeing. And plus, I'm a big animal lover. I love my dogs, and dogs are no different than chickens or lambs or cows or anything. So I thought, if I wouldn't want my dog to go through that horrific process, then I probably should move away from eating chicken and beef and stuff like that. Boy, you know, it was like a connecting the dots that had to happen for me, and I did gradually.
It really is something that we all want to turn away from, and I'm going to date myself here, but you know, I was in college, and I think this was 1970 or 71, and I read a book by a guy named Mark Singer, Animal Liberation, and I'm sure you know the book, Kathy, but I was destroyed by that book, and you know, I'm not gone as far as you have, but I haven't had a piece of beef since 1971 after reading a single book.
That's fantastic. And then you can look a cow right in the eyes and feel good about it, you know? It's like, and he does an excellent job of connecting those dots. And, you know, he's a Princeton professor, so it's a really smartly written book. And it's just about the ethics of food. Like, if we wouldn't want to carve up our dog or our cat, toast them in the oven, put them on a plate, then really it doesn't make sense to eat other animals. And again, I don't want to get heavy because you know, ethics is a personal choice, and everybody, you know, you certainly have the freedom to do whatever you want. I just wanted to be more aware of the process and then make my choices based on awareness and what I see. And then, you know, because I went in through that door of thinking about animals, then I did all the research on health, and because I thought, well, you know, everybody knows you need protein, protein, protein. And I assumed that protein was animal protein. So I thought, well, gosh, I really want to make sure I'm not doing my body a disservice here. And that's when I started learning about cholesterol and saturated fat and fiber and all the differences of nutrients that you get between plant-based foods and animal-based foods. And I became really excited about the shift to moving away from animal stuff to plant-based foods.
So the nutrition's there, that's one thing, but I want to mention this book is full of recipes. I think we all think that if we had a chef, a vegan chef, sure, we'd give it a try. We don't, you know, we're all intimidated on how to make good, exciting foods that are vegan. In our last 30 seconds, Kathy, how do we break that misconception?
Well, you look at these recipes and they're super duper easy, like one dish meals. Like one of my favorites is the sweet potato hash with beans in it. And so that you're getting, you know, really tons of protein. It's hearty. You can put on, you know, whatever you want in on top, like a grilled piece of tofu or a veggie burger, or you can throw in some broccoli or kale if you want lots of vegetables. And you see how inexpensive it is and how simple it is, because believe me, I am so not a chef, and these recipes are hearty and delicious, and you feel really great after them.
Folks, you don't become a vegan to be cool, but let me tell you, there are a lot of cool people out there, a lot of glam folks doing the vegan lifestyle, including Kathy Freston. The book is called The Book of Veganish, available everywhere. If you are at all curious about making the switch to a vegan diet and don't know where to begin, this book is the perfect way to get started. Kathy, thanks so much. Coming up, it's a little-known club of men and women with early cognitive dysfunction, and Growing Bolder is the first media group to be invited inside to watch a class and see what happens. That's next. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus. You're listening to Growing Bolder with Mark Middleton and Bill Schaefer. And folks, are you worried about dementia? Of course you are. We all are. Several recent studies reveal that baby boomers fear Alzheimer's disease more than even cancer or a heart attack.
You can understand why. Just the diagnosis of early stage dementia, that alone is enough to plunge almost anybody into a state of despair. The problem is we don't know what to expect. We think we're alone. We don't know who to turn to. And worst of all, we wonder if life will still be worth living.
We were invited into an amazingly successful but little-known program in Winter Park, Florida, the first of its kind access to the Brain Fitness Club. This is one of the most unique clubs in the world, the Brain Fitness Club in Winter Park, Florida.
All of the members have a memory impairment of some sort, Alzheimer's disease, Lewy body disease, frontal temporal lobe dementia. They're all in very early stages, so they all know they have a memory impairment and they want to be here.
The goal is to provide success-based, brain-friendly activities for individuals with early memory loss.
That also means that you have to forgive yourself. So when you do make a mistake, so what? Get over it. Whatever we're doing here, there's no damage comes from you making mistakes. So don't worry about those at all.
Facilitating and celebrating successes is what makes this program so unique and so powerful.
We're a capabilities-based program, so we don't look at disability at all. We only look at what our members can do, not what you can't. So you take what you're doing well and you keep doing well at it. Instead of a rehab program that takes what's broken and tries to fix it, we've never taken that approach.
Things you find in a hospital.
Doctors,
good.
Patients,
good. What else?
Well, I was having problems with my memory, and I found out that this was a really good place to come and where you can be yourself and not be afraid of saying the wrong thing or forgetting something, because we're all like that. We all have that problem. So it feels like a safe place.
I used to think that I'm alone, and I did more crying than anything else because I didn't know other people were going through the same thing. That alone made me more, not cheerful because they have what I have, but because I wasn't alone, I had a company.
It can be anything other than what it is. This can be anything other than a man's necktie. Everybody get ready to celebrate the beautiful bow in Linda's hair. Oh, look at how lovely she looks. Or it could be, right?
Bob Kodzis is one of the club's favorite instructors. He's a multi-talented performance artist and an expert on improvisation with an unusual job description.
I unleash human spirits. That's the broadest way I can describe it. I do that through teaching people, through facilitating meetings, through engaging people.
Bob's innate respect for the individual is remarkable, and that's what really enables him to be part of this, with just holding these people in the palm of his hand as he does his thing.
He just does everything funny, no matter what he's doing, makes you laugh. And that's a really good thing for people who have dementia, because we don't always feel happy.
Part of the quality of life issue with people who have memory challenges is they don't forgive themselves for forgetting, and that decreases the quality of their life. Improv teaches you it's okay to make mistakes, it's okay to forget.
I just do what I know I can do. And if I forget a word or get it wrong, then it's like, oh well, it'll come to me later or something. I mean, I don't take it seriously. And I accept that. And my husband is also very supportive of me. He doesn't get upset if I don't remember something or if I screw something up.
And so early on, I adopted a philosophy called, we have good days and bad moments. I try to minimize those bad moments and try to make the days the best we can.
And this is the best part of most days, an opportunity to have fun and feel good about what you can do and not feel bad about what you can't.
In firing line, I'm going to step in front of you and I'm going to say a word. You're going to say whatever word comes into your mind.
I clearly remember one of the members who said to me, Peggy, get out there and stop the stigma we're living with. People, when they hear I have Alzheimer's disease, they expect me to be in a nursing home drooling. And he said, I'm not, I'm living. And I want people to know that you can live with Alzheimer's disease. And so that's been my mission ever since he said that to me.
I don't feel bad if I don't understand something or I don't remember something. I just say I don't remember.
Bob was drawn to the Brain Fitness Club because he loves interacting with his elders and he loves the women who created the program.
I call them the Justice League. They're a group of ladies that are focused on helping people as they age, to age in place, to age healthily, to get the most out of life. And I love these ladies and I love what they do. I get more than I put into it. I mean, to see the smiles, to see them relax and enjoy it. And that's the payback they get from the universe. I get to help people.
Nuts.
Good job. All right, that's two down.
Bob's message to his audience is pretty much the same whether he's working with members of the Brain Fitness Club or senior executives from a Fortune 500 company.
I think we need to learn to love ourselves first, and then we learn to love everybody else. And I think if we start there, the quality of our lives is a lot better for the whole existence. So love, listen, connect with each other, and unleash what you got.
That's something we should all never forget.
All right, gang, once again, we are done.
Did you catch that, Grover Boulder?
Well, you might have noticed there were some members in that class that didn't want to be photographed and others who didn't want to be interviewed. And of course, we respected their privacy. But the others were willing and even anxious, Bill, to participate because they are enjoying their life. They're adjusting to their memory loss. They're working to slow it down. And more than anything else, they want others to know that not only is their life after a frightening diagnosis of dementia, there's actually a quality of life that they didn't think was possible.
What a great story, Mark, and so important because it's one of those things that nobody wants to think about, let alone talk about. So you've got to admire the fearlessness of those people in stepping forward. And it sure seems like the Brain Fitness Club itself is responsible for that. The members no longer seem ashamed or embarrassed by their condition.
Up next, the human genome has been fully mapped and the life-saving benefits are now ushering in the age of personalized medicine and changing the way we fight disease. This is Growing Bolder.
And the glimpse of our past fades away so fast, like a castanet dance in the night. And the glimpse of our past fades away so fast, like a castanet dance.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. This is Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. And we're going to talk now with somebody who is on the cutting edge of understanding how the human body works and sometimes doesn't work when it comes to responding to certain potential treatments.
Yeah, she is someone who has taken a very close look at how genetics, pharmacology, cellular biology, and biochemistry all interact together to better predict how potential cancer-fighting strategies might work. Let's learn more as we welcome from the UCF College of Medicine, Dr. Jane Gibson. Hey, Doc, how are you?
Good morning, Mark and Bill. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're excited to talk to you. This is a very exciting time, this era of personalized medicine. What exactly is going on? It seems like cancer treatment strategies are now beginning to vary where possible from patient to patient. Does that mean that our genetics might have more to do with it than we once thought?
Oh, absolutely. We are in a very, very exciting time in medicine right now where our knowledge that we've gained regarding human DNA and genetics is really playing a significantly increasing role in the way that we take care of patients. As you remember, probably a few years back, it was highly publicized that the National Institutes of Health and several other entities were involved in the Human Genome Project. And we've learned a tremendous amount from that effort, and it's really translating more effectively and more significantly to patient care today.
There's another term that keeps coming up that I'm assuming is kind of related to the personalized care that Mark was talking about. It's kind of a shift to a term called precision medicine. What is that?
Absolutely. It's a fabulous opportunity for us to utilize the information that we know about in a patient's DNA to not only diagnose the diseases that they have, particularly cancer, but also to look more closely at what treatment opportunities may be most appropriate for their cancer, and then ultimately, what is their prognosis, and may they carry some genetic susceptibility to developing a different cancer? So all important information that we get, which really allows us to formulate a very precise treatment and management strategies for those patients.
And you know, Doc, as exciting as all of this is, I would think it almost has to be a little bit overwhelming for researchers and doctors like yourself. It would be naive and fun to think that a disease would be treated the same with everybody, but the fact that everybody reacts differently and now a different kind of treatment might be required to, you know, to beat the disease in each person. I mean, it makes one treatment tens of thousands of millions of treatments, doesn't it?
It certainly can, but to be able to select the right treatment for patients does a number of things. With respect to patient care, it's so much easier on the patient if, for example, they can take a medicine or undergo a treatment that's less toxic for them while being more effective and then ultimately costing less money overall. So there are so many opportunities for us. You know, we have a number of new treatments that are available, but being able to have the tools to utilize them properly, you know, to tailor make or design precise care for each patient is exciting and certainly an opportunity that's going to shape the future of healthcare.
We're talking with Dr. Jane Gibson from the UCF College of Medicine. I've had this happen to me, and I'm thinking this is going to be a big problem for me moving forward, where you go to a new physician, right, and you're sitting in the office, and they're asking you things like, well, did your parents have heart disease or cancer? And sometimes it's you know, you stop and you think, and you go, well, gee, I'm not sure what to answer there, but it sounds like things like family medical history are going to be so important in helping your physician help cure you.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's so important for your physician to take a meaningful family history. And one of the things we've done here at our new College of Medicine is we've incorporated precision medicine and genetics very, very intricately into our curriculum, where we teach them the first 8 weeks of medical school, the importance of a proper family history. And when I see patients, I always encourage them, especially in the summertime, when you're going to that family reunion or if you're getting together over the holidays as the fall progresses, talk to your relatives about the information that you can get from them with respect to your ancestors and what diseases they might have had and the ages at which they had them. It's very important in terms of giving your personal physician clues regarding what to look for in your personal health management.
You know, Doc, I think the more that we learn about the education that medical students are getting today, especially at a place like the UCF College of Medicine, it's so encouraging. But so much is changing so rapidly, and it's obvious to hear from your voice that, you know, you embrace the opportunity to go with this change. But you've got to be nimble, don't you, when you're a medical educator these days in order to keep up with everything that's happening?
We sure do. I mean, we certainly emphasize recognizing what the national practice standards are with respect to professional societies making recommendations on how to use this information. All of our faculty and many of our students regularly attend national professional meetings where these types of topics are discussed and debated and agreed on nationally with respect to what is the right approach, what is the best approach. So as you say, it's changing very quickly, and maintaining a cutting-edge advantage to taking care of patients is essential in contemporary healthcare. We are all committed to doing it, and we're teaching our students how to do it as well.
And Dr. Gibson, we're also kind of curious, as just regular folks out here, what is on the horizon for those of us? What are we going to be hearing about in the coming months and years as far as changing treatments?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things that we will be able to offer patients in the future, and I really stress in the future, I mean, part of it is here today, but is the ability to sequence an entire genome from each patient. And we have the technical ability to do that now, but interpreting the results and really being able to process these huge amounts of information and distilling it down for each patient with respect to his or her care is going to be a daunting process. We also think that this information, where we can sequence a patient's genome, should be able to be imported and cared for and maintained, if you will, in electronic health records. So we are at a point now where our technology is going to allow us to manage each patient based on their genome. But the amount of information and understanding the implications of every DNA change continue to be challenging. So I think that we will continue to tackle that as time goes forward, and we're going to have a lot of information about how each DNA change relates to disease susceptibility, diagnosis, treatment, and prevention.
You know, Doc, unfortunately, I think all of us have a loved one or someone that we care a great deal about that's battling cancer of some kind. It seems like much of the game, if you will, these days is buying time, because so many of these are currently incurable. And isn't that a lot about what we're trying to do? I mean, there's so many things that could happen so quickly that there's a lot of people that are just trying to, you know, to hang on until, you know, there's good news.
Sure. You know, one of the big advantages of precision medicine is the ability to target the therapy. If we can take a genetic defect or a change in the DNA and identify what chemotherapeutic agent or treatment is most appropriate for that patient, targeting only the cancer cells and leaving the normal cells intact, it's going to give the patient an overall better chance of having a better outcome long term.
What is it like for you, Doc, you know, to be kind of at the UCF College of Medicine, where you're not just educating, you're also motivating the next generation of physicians?
I absolutely love what I do. It's really a privilege to be in the classroom with 120 young student physicians each year, teaching them about this, passionately explaining to them, you know, the importance of this. And we actually bring patients into the classroom the first 8 weeks of medical school so that the students not only learn the science and medicine behind genetics and precision medicine, but they also get to talk to patients and learn early on what it's like for those patients and the meaning of the power of genomic medicine with respect to how we can take care of them, both now and in the future, because we know that this is going to continue to evolve and change during their practice lifetimes, and I'm just honored to be part of that.
And, Doc, maybe in our final 20 seconds, a word about the importance of lifestyle and lifestyle modification, because I know one of the things that you guys are learning as you learn more about genetics is that some genes, whether they express themselves or not, is determined by the way that we live. So we do have some control over our genes to some extent, don't we?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think a good lifestyle and a healthy lifestyle are always ways that we can enhance our chances of having any negative effects from genetic predisposition to disease. So certainly those are the kinds of things that are in our hands, and we have the power as patients to certainly take some control over our health, regardless of our genetics, by living a healthy lifestyle.
Fascinating and great conversation with Dr. Jane Gibson from the UCF College of Medicine.
Up next, the oldest employed teacher in America who at 102 years old still teaches class nearly every day. Well, she's going to school us on the art of growing bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble to neglect.
Bill Schaefer and Mark Middleton here, and you are listening to Growing Bolder. Our next guest is someone who provides inspiration every single day. Now, she's a teacher who has been at her school in New Jersey for more than 20 years, but here's what makes her so amazing. She spent most of her life as a stay-at-home mom, and only at the age of 81 did she even start her teaching career.
Yeah, and if you do the math, you realize that she is now 102, still working almost full-time as a cooking and sewing teacher at the Sundance School in North Plainfield, New Jersey. She has recently been recognized as America's oldest teacher. Let's welcome 102-year-old Agnes Zalesnik, or as her students and coworkers lovingly call her, Granny. Hey, Granny.
Oh, yes. They like to call me Granny. Am I ready?
Oh, we're doing it. We're on the air right now. Granny, what made you decide to start a...
All righty. You want to know why the children are so great? They are innocent. They love to mix in cooking. And the girls, they love to sew and start something, so I try to make something simple so they could put it together and things on that order. And then the cooking, I try to use and I also read up on the latest food, you know, that they have out I look at the recipes and see if it's something different other than natural butter. And maybe once in a while the recipe calls for sour cream. Now when I start in September, it's pretty warm, so I'm going to try to make salads like potato salad and cucumber salad and so on, but different kind of salads. And they use the same salad for a whole week because different classes come in.
Can I ask you a question, Agnes? Are you almost 80 years old now?
You're asking my daughter?
No, how old are you?
Oh, I am 102 already, and I'm heading for 103.
And you're still working. Why are you still working?
Why am I? Well, when you get old, you still eat. Otherwise, you know, you have to... The foods are expensive, and you don't have the money to buy the good foods for old people. But I love to work. That's number one. And I try to pay some of my bills and so on. That's why I work. And I like that work. And I love my children. And they hire such beautiful teachers, not in looks exactly, but how they teach.
Well, Granny, let me ask you this, because you have been getting a whole lot of attention lately as America's oldest teacher. So teach us something right now. What can we do to be more like you, to live to be 102 and to still enjoy our life like you do? What's your secret?
Well, that's not really my secret. It's my mother's secret. She started like on a little farm and fed us to start your cells growing well by giving you good food like whole milk and organic vegetables. And I grew up that way till about 12 or 15 years old. And that, I think the mothers today have to look into, I don't know, my secret is my mother was very smart. She was European, but she knew so much. And I think that's where you really start. You have to eat good food when you're young, and I get the young children, so I'm trying to take the place of someone that will feed them well and give them good food. But I have to keep up with magazines, and because these young girls, they're learning a lot in college and so on, so I have to learn from them too.
So many of us start to feel like when we're 65 that we're old and we're tired and we're ready to wind down. But Agnes, you're still living such a vibrant life. What do you know that the rest of us are missing?
My private life. I keep busy. I do some sewing for my great-grandchildren, and I make these little skull caps that you see around. So I crochet them and make different colors and, make it interesting looking for heads.
We are speaking, folks, with Agnes Zalesnik, who is the oldest teacher in America. She's getting ready to start another school year, getting her lesson plan together. She teaches cooking, and she teaches sewing, what we used to call home ec, to students who are from kindergarten through the fifth grade. Agnes, what do you think about being named America's oldest teacher? Does that excite you? Are you proud of that?
I am kind of proud of being healthy enough and able to do it. That's most of the biggest secret is being able to think, and my brains seem to work. They think they do, and I think they work pretty well. And I don't hear so well, but I have a hearing aid, and I just make everything useful. They have a lot of new inventions. And I just love what I'm doing. So I continue it.
So, Agnes, are you thinking about what you're going to do when you retire?
When I retire? It depends on when I retire and how I feel when I retire. I don't want to retire if I'm well and able to do things. And right now, I'm not retiring. I'm able to do it.
Granny, before we go, one last word of wisdom. What's the moral to your story? What can we learn about life from you? What do you want us to know?
What I want you to know, treat the children well. They are so important in life. They're going to take care of you because they're learning simple things now, but it's going to get bigger and better and bigger to help you. And don't think people think they're not going to get old, but they will. So you have to learn from the kids later on.
Granny, that's great advice. Thank you so much. And folks, I hope it's not lost on anybody what we've just experienced. A rare conversation with a 102-year-old teacher who still works nearly full-time. And this is, in the best possible way, a look into what's possible for all of us. As Agnes Granny Zaleski shared with us, it's just a matter of keeping busy, enjoying your life, keeping your mind active. At 102, she still teaches, she still sews, she still gives back to her community. What a great treasure she is, and what a wonderful bit of time to spend with 102-year-old Granny Zalesnik. Up next, what would motivate a 93-year-old man to walk from coast to coast, and how in the heck did he do it? That's next on Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. This is Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and we're going to talk to somebody right now who's going to make you take every preconceived notion you ever had about what's possible with age and chuck the thing right out the window. First off, he's a 93-year-old runner, and not so long ago, just that would have been enough to make him remarkable. But Mark, that's not the case anymore.
No, you know, that's a good point. The standard for remarkable is continually raised almost every day, but by any standard, this guy is still remarkable. He has run the equivalent of at least a half marathon a week, every week for three straight years since he turned 90 years old. Man. Something else, he's just become the oldest person ever to run clear across the country from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And I'm going to say it one more time, folks, he is 93 years old. Let's welcome the amazing Ernie Andrus. Hey, Ernie.
Yeah, right here.
There he is, right there, folks. First of all, congratulations on the new world record. How you feeling these days?
I'm feeling great.
And Ernie, you did not simply run across the country to break a record either. We want to let people know that you're a World War II veteran, and you had a very special reason to try to raise some money. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I decided to run this just for the fun of it. But when I found that my age drew a lot of attention, I decided to try to raise some money for a World War II ship. A few years ago, we were on the History Channel. A group of us veterans went over to Greece and found an LST, and we brought it back on its own power. And right now, I was hoping I could raise enough money to take it back to Normandy for the memorial service 75 years later. I haven't raised that much money, but I have raised it quite a bit, and whatever I've raised will keep the ship going. Can we take it around to different ports?
And Ernie, we want to talk more about your run and why you did it, but tell us a little more about this ship. What's your connection to it, and why did you care so much about it?
Well, during World War II, I served the first part of the war, and I served all, the whole war in the Pacific. The first part of the war, I was on a transport where we took the wound, we took the troops over and brought the wounded back. I was in the hospital corps. And then I went over, took a merchant marine ship out to New Caledonia, and that's where I picked up LST-124. Now, that's the one, LST-124 is identical to the 325, which is the one we have now. And they built 1,051 of those LSTs during World War II. Both Eisenhower and Churchill both made a similar remark that it's the ship that won the war. Well, there's none left now. This is the only one out of all of them that's still operational. We got it all restored now. We can take it around to the different ports to show the people. And I think it's important that people know about the LST because few people have even heard of it, see. Everybody knows about battleships and cruisers and aircraft carriers, but not much was said about the LST. We were very proud of that ship. And that's, we were looking for one for about 10 years, and we finally found this one over in Greece.
Man, Ernie, I've got to make sure that everybody listening knows what a gem you are. I mean, you are what we all hope that we can be. Listen to this man talk. You're in your 90s. You're thinking into the future, working on a project. You're in shape. Tell us, what is it like to be such an inspiration and really redefining what it is to be in your 90s?
Well, I've been having a lot of fun. I only had one run that wasn't fun. That's when my fingers froze up in New Mexico. Outside of that, it's just been a lot of fun. I've met some great people all the way across the nation. And everyone has been helpful and willing to support.
Folks, we're talking with Ernie Andrus, and if you're just joining us, he ran clear across the country after he was 90 years old to raise money to restore an old World War II ship. Ernie, you have a lot of time when you're running, when you're alone. What did you think about? Did you reflect on life? Did you learn anything about yourself or about life in general during this run?
Well, I learned that if you're over 90 running coast to coast, people take notice. And it's, I also learned that I know from experience when I was a kid that history was a dull subject. And now so many young people are starting to take an interest because when they meet me, they think they've met some of history. And the history teacher, a lot of the history teachers are using my run across the country in their class.
And, you know, Ernie, I think in people in their heads, they may have a picture of you in their minds as being some elite athlete, you know, somebody who's very unique and different. But really, you're kind of an ordinary guy.
Yeah, I've got my problems. I've got a good heart and good lungs. That keeps me going. My veins are so bad that the doctor says I'm a candidate for anything. A doctor knows what to do. But they say what I'm doing is better than anything they need to do. Just keep moving.
We all have these grandiose ideas every now and then, Ernie, where we want to do something that we think is going to make a splash or make a difference. And then we get into it and we think, what the heck was I thinking? How long did it take you to have that thought? What was I thinking? I mean, this is a pretty big country once you get started, isn't it?
Well, I heard about a guy that was running across every country. He was from Great Britain. And he stopped in our town in Prescott, Arizona, and overnight. And I just thought, that sounds like something fun to do. So when I ran my first 200-mile relay, I was 88 years old. And I got so much attention that they even featured me in their magazine, and everybody wanted pictures taken with me, and just because of my age. So I thought, well, if an 88-year-old man gets this much attention in a a relay. How about a 90-year-old man running coast to coast? Maybe I could raise some money for the ship.
And that's how this whole thing started. Ernie, your story touched so many hearts. People want to know more about you. What do you think about that? What is it like to become a celebrity when you're in your 90s?
Well, it's been a good feeling. I've got literally thousands of people who have said they've I've inspired them to get back to exercising, and I think that's good for our nation. And the kids, I get a lot of chances to talk to kids in school. I love the fifth graders because they're the kids that have all the questions. And they're the kids that are willing to learn.
And what is the overriding message, Ernie? What do you want to teach them? What do you want them to know?
Well, I want them mainly to know that freedom is not free. And they've got to be prepared for the future. I tell these kids that it don't, you know, I hope there's never another war, but if there is, be prepared. Be ready. Don't hesitate to go into the service. Be good for you, and you'll be ready in case the country needs you. And you better hope they don't.
Well, Ernie, bless you for what you did back then, and bless you for what you're doing to this day, because you are having an impact on so many other people. Folks, if you'd like to help Ernie out, it's not too late. Check out his website at coasttocoastruns.com. Our thanks to 93-year-old Ernie Andrus.
We've heard from some pretty impressive people on this program, so now it's time to take a minute to think about you. What's your Growing Bolder story? What do you want it to be? Think about it, craft it, and then find a way to start living it.
Go to growingbolder.com. Take control. Start living your life to the fullest, because that's Growing Bolder.